I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Maggie Lacoze, co-founder of La Bernardin, a leading seafood restaurant in New York City. Maggie started La Bernardin in 1986 with her brother Gilbert after operating the restaurant with the same name in Paris. When Gilbert died from a heart attack in 1994, Eric Repair took over as the restaurant's co-owner and chef. Maggie and Eric are co-authors of La Bernardin Cookbook. La Bernardin has been awarded 3 Michelin stars and has held 4 stars from the New York Times since it opened. Welcome.
Thank you.
What are your earliest memories of eating fish?
Oh, from the very beginning, I didn't like meat. So that was easy. When I was very young, 3-4 years old, I was eating in the dining room in our little hotel restaurant in Brittany with my brother, and we were eating fish.
So you lived in Brittany, and your parents operated a small hotel restaurant. How involved were you in the restaurant? What roles did you have?
We were involved very early, like peeling potatoes. We were stuffing clams. We were 7 or 8 years old. I was in the dining room with my mother, and my brother was in the kitchen with my father. And then my father had this idea, as he had 2 grown-up kids, to open a disco.
Tell me about the disco. This is now in the 1960s?
Yes, and it was one of the first disco in Brittany, so we were very successful, but we didn't know how to make money. And then later on, my brother was in his early 20s, he was working as in a disco in Paris. And then he really learned how to make money.
What kind of music played in the disco at the time?
The music of the Rolling Stone.
And your grandfather was a fisherman. Do you recall going out with him to catch fish?
Not me. I didn't like too much going on the boat, but my brother really liked doing that. And he preferred to go on the boat with my grandfather than to go to school, to tell you the truth. He was very young when he started to go on the boat with him. And one day there was a tempest that raised very quickly, and they had to tie him up with ropes to prevent him to be thrown away off the boat.
Did you both know from the early days that you wanted to go into business together and open a restaurant together? How did that happen?
Not at all. I wanted to be a stewardess, and my brother wanted to work on boats, but the kind of big boats where they go far away.
Cargo?
Yes, cargo. Oh.
Why did you want to be a stewardess?
Because I wanted to get out of Brittany and travel. That was it. I knew early in my life that I would not stay in Brittany. It was too remote, and I knew that there was a life somewhere else.
Eventually, you and your brother moved to Paris.
Yes.
But before opening the restaurant, you dabbled in different areas for a few years. What are some of the things that you did?
I modeled for a couple of years. Then I was a receptionist in an hotel. Then I was hostess in a restaurant. And every year we would come back to Brittany to help our parents.
How did you both then make the decision to open the restaurant?
Because there was nothing else that we knew. We didn't know that it was going to be so difficult, because the small training that we had in that small hotel restaurant was not enough to make a success in Paris. So we opened that restaurant in Paris in 72 with the help of everyone, friends, family, loan at the bank. It was a disaster. We didn't know how to run the restaurant to make money. We were having fun being outside every night after when the restaurant was closed. And several times we thought that we would we had to file for bankruptcy.
Your restaurant was almost taken away at one point.
That's right.
What is the story behind that?
One day I went for whatever reason to the market with my brother. And we came back with the small car full of fish, and we saw a notice on the window, for sale. This is our restaurant, this is us. And said, so I called the number and a man came. He said, all right, young lady, I'm going to help you. Can we sit somewhere? I said, yes, please come to my apartment. It's above the restaurant. He said, I'm going to help you. We can just take a lean on your furniture. What do you have? Here, I have one table, which is my desk, and two chairs. And I have my bedroom. I have my bed, and that's it. He said, that's the only thing I cannot take. So it's to show you how difficult it has been.
But despite this difficulty initially, you were actually opening a restaurant at an auspicious moment. Your brother, who was a chef with no formal training, benefited from a new experimentation going on in the French culinary community at the time. What impact do you think that had on your brother's cooking?
It was the beginning of the nouvelle cuisine. He tried to have some imagination. All the chefs were trying new way to get out of that heavy French cooking. So it was, in a way, the right time. He became friendly with all the chefs of his generation, went to have dinner with them, started to travel with them. They were always invited everywhere in France, whether it's to taste the truffles that were coming out or to taste wine. That's when everything started to come in his mind, I suppose.
And the first restaurant was called Le Bernardin.
It was called Le Bernardin, yes.
What does that mean?
It is a song that our father was singing to us called Les Moines de Saint Bernardin. Those monks were well known for the good life. They liked to eat and to drink. And that first location was on the left bank, not far from the restaurant that we were going to open. So we named the restaurant after those monks.
So you're talking about monks in a monastery? There's a monastery,
yes,
close to you? And monks obviously are known for their asceticism.
Yes, not those one.
I see. And so your father would sing this song to,
yes,
you growing up?
Yes. It's a well-known song.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Maggie Lacoz, co-founder of Le Bernardin, a leading seafood restaurant in New York City. Maggie started Le Bernardin in 1986 with her brother, Gilbert. You operated the Paris restaurant from 1972 to 1987 in two locations.
Yes.
And the impetus for your closing the restaurant in Paris was that you opened up a New York restaurant.
Exactly.
In 1986.
Yes.
Why did you decide to move to New York?
It's very difficult to say because I didn't know New York. It's out of the blue. I was pushed by I don't know what or who, but it was very strong. And I started in the 1980 already to think about New York. I came once with my brother and we stayed 2 weeks, and my brother said, there is nothing here. There is no good vegetable, there is no herb, there is nothing. We cannot open a restaurant. And I told him, you are a coward. But he said, no way. We are not ready. And this town is not ready. We cannot do it. So a few years later, I told him, I don't want to stay here all my life. You will be 50 years old with a big belly behind your stove, and I will be with white hair at the entrance. I told him, I don't want a family, I'm not interested. I just want to run another business.
So you're eager to open a restaurant in New York, your brother not so much. What next? You tried a few times to start a restaurant, but investors repeatedly fell through.
It took me several times. One time I thought that I had everything. I had 10 different investment partner friends. And at the last minute, there was always one who would say no. And one year, I came back and I had almost a nervous breakdown because a deal didn't go through.
And then finally, a partnership randomly came together with essentially a stranger in New York City. You met Mr. Holloway, who was the head of Equitable.
Yes, he was the chairman of Equitable.
And Equitable is the real estate company that owns the building that you've been in.
Yes.
How did you meet him?
We met him through a friend of mine whose brother was a very good friend of Ben Holloway. And he knew that he was finishing that huge building on the west side, which was not at that time a very well-known location.
155 West 51st Street.
So we went to his house. We opened a bottle of Dom Pérignon. We shook hands, said, that's it, we have a deal. Do you have an architect? Yes, we do. Tell your architect to get in touch with the architect of the building tomorrow. Do you have a lawyer? Yes, we do. Tell your lawyer to get in touch with the lawyer of the building and let's work on him. I said, but we don't have a deal. He said, we'll work on that. So they started to build the restaurant. We signed the deal 6 months later. He had so much trust and confidence with us that he knew that we were going to do it.
What was the restaurant landscape at the time in that neighborhood in Midtown?
It was not a good neighborhood. At night, we had some of our employees who were mugged. Nobody thought that it could be a right location. And we thought that it was going to be a right location because we were next to Rockefeller Center and next to Broadway.
But it was kind of accidental that you launched in this neighborhood.
Yes, that's right, because we had a very good deal.
How did you get financing from the beginning? Even you had Equitable as your landlord.
Yes.
But did they provide the capital to get the restaurant off the ground?
It was a turnkey operation.
A turnkey operation?
Yes, meaning that they would do all the work and then buy table, chairs, china, glassware, everything.
Lucky you.
Yes.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Maggie Lacoze, co-founder of Le Bernardin. We'll hear more from Maggie coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Maggie Lacoze, co-founder of Le Bernardin, one of the country's leading seafood restaurants. Maggie started the New York restaurant in 1986 with her brother Gilbert, and Le Bernardin received 3 Michelin stars and 4 stars from the New York Times as soon as it opened. She partnered with celebrity chef Eric Rappaire after Gilbert died in 1994. The restaurant changed its decor to produce a more contemporary feel in the autumn of 2011. Now, your brother came to New York kicking and screaming because it was your wish. Did you ever think that maybe you and your brother should part ways because you wanted to be in New York and he wanted to be in Paris?
Well, no, we were very, very close, and that was enough.
Your brother was protesting that there are no good herbs and no good vegetables. Where did he find, or where did you both find, the produce and the fish for your restaurant in Midtown?
The good thing was that New York is on the water, so Gilbert figured out that some fish were going to come to New York. He just had to find where to find them. He went to the Fulton Fish Market. Was the first restaurateur ever going to the fish market. That was very interesting because he made the fish market discovered by the journalist who came with him, and then the TV went with him to the fish market, and suddenly the fish market has been known, and then the fishmonger was happy to be on TV, so we were treated very well with them.
So your brother brought publicity to Fulton Fish Market.
Yes.
Because journalists and the TV crew would follow your brother.
Mm-hmm.
Now, your brother did not speak English very well.
Gilbert didn't speak English. So his way to connect with them was just pointing out the fish and just pointing out the fish that they wanted to sell, which is no good. He would say, no, no good. And that was it. And after a while, they understood that he really knew how to choose the fish.
So your brother was an expert in fish thanks to his family upbringing.
Yes, thanks to my grandfather, who was the fisherman.
And when you were first launching the restaurant in 1986, what were some of the challenges that you faced?
We could not find waiters. So we took our maitre d' from Paris with us, and the dining room became a school for 1 month. And we had at that time the biggest kitchen in New York. We had the first page of the New York Times with a picture of the kitchen. And we were serving dinner every night in the kitchen to train the waiters. And then we started to train waiter in the dining room, like having just 5 or 6 tables and increasing every day. And we had no publicity, no public relation to help us, just people would see that there was light and that they heard that the Bernardin was opening, and they would knock at the door and say, when are you going to be open? We said, we don't know, when we will be ready. And one night, Gilbert said, okay, we'll be ready soon. Maggie, you get 50 people in the dining room and nothing else for 1 month.
Do you remember what was on the menu the first night when you opened?
We had raw fish on the menu. Nobody in New York had eaten raw fish except in a few sushi places. So I would take the order at the table with the maître d' and convince people to try to take the raw fish. And I would say, please, try it. And if you don't like it, we'll give you something else. There was a lot of tuna in New York. And the tuna, when it's too cooked, it's not good at all. So I said to my brother, listen, why don't we serve it raw? So we had carpaccio of tuna. We had some raw fish marinated that we serve on a green salad. We had sea urchin, which was not very popular. So we had a sea urchin in a butter of sea urchin. We had oyster, of course. We had oyster with truffle, which was very unusual as well. We had fish soup. We had skate.
Squid.
Yes. We had served monkfish, which was not very well known either, that we would serve with leeks.
All that on the first night?
Oh, yes. When we were ready, we were ready. And every week, I would increase a little bit.
Now, your responsibilities were always split between your being in the front of the house and his always being the chef. Did you ever try to cook yourself?
No, I never tried because I never had the opportunity. That was not the tradition in the 50s and 60s to have women in the dining room. It was women in the front and men in the kitchen.
You mentioned that your brother had no traditional training and
That's
that
right.
He was really more of an artist and he used his imagination. How did that help him in the kitchen, do you think, versus having a formal training?
Because our food was different, was very light. There was some broth, then emulsion.
Emulsion.
Yes. Spices, herbs. His menu was simple, but that's what was important because then really people started to appreciate the fish. And the fish was so fresh that it was really good.
You mentioned green salad, that you served fish on top of green salad.
Yes. Oh, that was a big deal.
What was Gilbert's relationship with salad?
Oh, a nightmare. Because we had customer coming and asking for a green salad. And he says, no, we are not serving green salad. I said, why not? Because you are in the restaurant. It's a fish restaurant, and I don't go to the fish market every night to serve a green salad. That was it. We would not serve green salad.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Maggie Lacoze, co-founder of Le Bernardin, one of the country's leading seafood restaurants. Maggie started the New York restaurant in 1986 with her brother Gilbert, and Le Bernardin received 3 Michelin stars and 4 stars from the New York Times as soon as it opened. The restaurant changed its decor to produce a more contemporary feel in the autumn of 2011. Incidentally, when exactly did you open the restaurant to the public?
The restaurant was ready by November 1985. We knew that it was not the right time to open in the middle of the season, but we opened in January, which had always been successful for us. All the restaurants that we opened in January.
What were some of the mistakes you made in the early days of the restaurant?
I don't think we made mistakes. We were strong enough not to open the restaurant and to accept a lot of customers the first 2 months. So when Gail Green, who was the first person who reviewed the restaurant, came, the restaurant was ready. Her friends was telling her, you must go to the restaurant, it's really good. She said, I promised them not to go before they tell me that they are ready. So finally she came, and Brian Miller came right away.
Brian Miller of the New York Times.
Yes.
Which gave you 4 stars.
Which was a big deal for him because it was the first, it was at the beginning of him being at the New York Times, and it was the first 4 star that he gave. In his first article that he did, he said, I wish that we can take their passport so that they don't go back to France. And suddenly we were overwhelmed with the phones. We couldn't answer the phones. We had 5 person on the reservation, and it was not enough. We had to buy a sophisticated answering machine to take over. Nobody could reach us. It was very special. It was special days.
When you got your 4 stars from the New York Times,
yes.
Do you remember that moment when you found out?
Yes, we found out because by coincidence, we had that night friends coming from France, and I said, you arrive right on time. Tonight we are going to see what we are going to get with the New York Times. The manager came at that moment with plenty of New York Times in his hands and threw away the newspaper in the restaurant.
The manager threw the newspaper in the air.
Absolutely. And in the private room, we had a reservation. It was 15 people. And they were all people from the New York Times. They all came down the stairs, and everybody was applauding.
Oh.
And everyone in the restaurant started to understand. So everyone started to applaud, and it was really a wonderful moment. And then we went outside to celebrate. When we came back, we called our father and explained him. And he said, so, you didn't go to the Fulton Fish Market this morning, my son?
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Maggie Lacoze, co-founder of Le Bernardin, one of the country's leading seafood restaurants. Your brother, Gilbert, passed away in 1994 from a heart attack?
From a heart attack, yes.
Was it sudden?
Yes, it was sudden, but not really. A year before, he had a kind of small attack. At night, he woke up and his girlfriend, she rushed him to the hospital. And 3 days later, he asked the maître d' and Eric and the manager to come to the hospital with the mail, and in front of them he took all the tube that he had in his hand. He said, I am fine, and don't say anything to my sister or you will be fired.
So he took out all the tubes, all the needles and tubes from the hospital?
Yes. If I had known, I would have battled and fight with him so that to do the test. He was supposed to do tests that he never did.
So your brother kept his heart attack a secret so you wouldn't worry and force him to undergo a series of tests.
Yes.
Eric Repair, your now chef and co-owner,
yes.
Came on board, took over in 1994 when your brother passed away. Eric had been working in the kitchen with Gilbert.
With Gilbert, yes.
What was that relationship like?
Gilbert was very friendly with Jean-Louis Paladin, a very well-known chef who was running a restaurant in the Watergate Hotel in Washington. He's the first French chef who came to the United States. And Gilbert asked him if he had someone that he could recommend because he knew that that could not go further than what he has done, that he really need new blood. And Jean-Louis Paladin introduced him to my brother. And Eric, it took like a few months before Eric accepted it. They were meeting every Saturday at breakfast and talked about everything. They became friends before they became the chef of the restaurant.
Now, Eric's style of cooking is very different from your brother's. Gilbert was more ad hoc and there was no formal education, whereas Eric is well-schooled.
Oh, yes. Eric has the best training.
How is that manifested in the menu? How is the menu different as a result of now having Eric on board versus Gilbert?
When Gilbert died, I said to Eric, Eric, we have to stop. Don't do it at all, anything that Gilbert was doing, except the raw fish. We'll keep that, and everything has to be new.
How come?
Because I wanted to really to show that I should no longer think of my brother and that Eric was a chef and that he was talented and that I wanted to show his talent.
I could see it going the other way. I could see some owners saying, I want you to continue in my brother's tradition. So it was probably freeing for Eric to have that
yes.
license from you.
Yes, definitely.
When the reviewers came to review the restaurant under Eric's auspices,
yes.
what were the results?
It was Ruth Reichel in 1995.
And?
4 stars.
4 stars.
Yes.
New York Times. Are you tearing up because this is emotional for you?
Absolutely. It's 40 years of my life. But Eric and I, we are very close. We are like friends. I consider him like more than a business partner. He's my family. He's like my brother in a sense.
And Eric is really the public face of the restaurant to some degree. The star of a TV series called Avec Eric,
yes.
and a judge on Top Chef. How do you feel about his taking on that role with the restaurant, whereas you're more, not behind the scenes, because you're in from the front of the restaurant, but you certainly don't have your own TV series, and you're not the one that has as much fame as he.
It's wonderful. I can go away whenever I want. And nobody is asking for me. Everybody is asking for Eric. It doesn't make a difference if I am there or not, because I have a computer everywhere I go. I do the administration work in the restaurant. So every day I speak with everyone and I look at the numbers and that's fine.
Now, how has your job changed from the inception, from 1986 when you opened to now? What does your job entail?
In 1986, I was in the front. I was at the podium greeting people and then going to one table to the other, seeing if everything was fine. Mm-hmm. And then I would be in the restaurant from 6 o'clock to midnight, saying goodbye to the last customer. Plus the work in the office, it was very long days.
How has your clientele's taste changed from the beginning of the restaurant's opening till now?
They are very sophisticated now, yes. I don't remember, but what I can tell you is in one night we could have 15 tables taking tasting menus with wine pairing. So it means that the clientele is really sophisticated. They know about food.
There are so many restaurateurs expanding and having 2, 3, 5, 10 restaurants, whether they're all in New York or in other states. How come you're sticking with Le Bernardin only.
This is our choice. We like to be unique. When the customer comes, we want that experience to be very special. We always manage to be in the restaurant, either Eric or me, so that the customer can have that special experience. If they want to meet with us, we are there.
What is your diet like? What did you eat for breakfast this morning?
I eat cornflakes with skim milk, grapefruit that the restaurant prepare for me, and Greek yogurt. And lunch, it's green salad with vegetables and fruits.
How often are you eating in the restaurant?
Every day, lunch and dinner. And dinner, I pick up everything from the menu. I taste everything. And I sit down in the dining room, and I want to be served like a customer. That's where I see the details.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Maggie Lacoze, co-founder of Le Bernardin. Coming up, we'll meet Peter Thiel, co-founder of PayPal. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.
Nous nous couchons tard et nous levons matin.
Pour aller à Matine, vider quelques flacons. Voilà ce qui est bon et bon, bon, bon.
Et voilà la vie, la vie, la vie, la vie, c'est rire. Ah, ah. Et voilà la vie que tous les mois de temps. Et voilà la vie, la vie, la vie, la vie, c'est rire. Ah, ah. Et voilà la vie que tous les mois de temps.
I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Peter Thiel, the co-founder and former CEO of PayPal, an online payment system where anyone with an email address can send money using their credit card or their bank account. In 2002, eBay bought PayPal for $1.5 billion. Welcome. Typically, it's striking to me how when entrepreneurs start out launching a company, the company they set out to launch looks a lot different from the company it becomes ultimately. And I was wondering if you are a victim to that type of evolution.
Well, we started the company in late 98, and we launched the initial PayPal product in the fall of 1999. And I would certainly say that the very first year that we went through a number of different cycles in terms of trying to figure out what we were going to do. We started with security technology on mobile devices, a wallet, sort of a mobile cell phone payment system. And then in the summer and early fall of 1999, we stumbled on this idea of linking money with email. And I think you're right. This is not an unusual kind of a way for things to develop, especially at the very early stages of the company.
My understanding was that you went out to venture capitalists initially to try to raise money for this encryption software called FieldLink. And you weren't being very successful in raising that money, so then you then decided, okay, well, let's start a company called Confinity, which does provide payment options using the internet.
Yes. Yeah, we went through several different names early on. There was a FieldLink, then there was Confinity, and then we hit on we actually hired a naming company, and they came up with 1,000 different names, and we liked PayPal the best. But yes, so we did iterate through a whole bunch of these things. I probably spoke with had maybe 100 separate meetings with venture capitalists or more in the course of 1999.
How did you meet your partner, Max Levchin? He's from the Ukraine, mm-hmm. and he was a programmer since he was about 10 years old. How did you and he come into contact initially?
I was giving a talk at Stanford in the summer of 98, and we talked afterwards and became friends, and basically he was trying to figure out how to start another company. He had already started a few of them back in college at University of Illinois. I was actually in the process of I was running a very small fund at the time and helping invest in various companies and things like that. We basically started working together. I was going to help him find a CEO, so I helped him interview various people. And then at the end of the process, he asked me to be the CEO. And I said, well, you know, I'll do this for a few months till we get somebody else. And it then evolved into a four-year commitment. It was quite a quite an extraordinary time.
What was your lecture, by the way, about at Stanford?
It was related to international finance or something like that, which is my background had been in finance.
You spent quite a lot of time at Stanford. You went to undergrad at Stanford, and then you went to Stanford Law School. And while you were at Stanford College, you started the Stanford Review, which is a libertarian conservative paper.
I had gone to Stanford for 7 years in a row, and so there was a whole set of people from that area that I was, you know, pretty familiar with, and had worked together. And it was actually one of the great things when we started PayPal was there were a lot of people we were able to hire from out of that network.
You're talking about the importance of community, which you really found in Silicon Valley and in Stanford. But it's ironic to me because it seems like both you and Max, to some degree, had quite a nomadic upbringing. Can you tell me a little bit about where you're from and how you got to California ultimately?
I was born in Germany. My parents emigrated to the U.S. when I was about a year old. We lived in Africa for a few years. And so I ended up going to about 7 different elementary schools, which is kind of a lot. But from about junior high school on, we were living in Northern California. Max was born in the Ukraine, as you said, and his parents emigrated to the U.S. when he was 16 years old. And as Max liked to put it, they left in August of '91, which is in the weeks when the Soviet Union disappeared and was replaced by Russia. And so he was a citizen of no country.
What was the impetus for your family to move to the
U.S.? My dad was just doing some master's college work in the U.S., and so he was an engineer.
And what was your mom doing?
My mom had been working for an airline, but then basically became a homemaker when my brother and I were born. And, you know, our family was sort of extremely – all sorts of things about everyone's families that are kind of eccentric and strange and interesting. But I think we were very, very focused on education. I remember one anecdote when I was growing up in fifth grade. My mother concluded that we weren't doing enough work in school, and the teacher wasn't pushing us hard enough. So one day, you know, she showed up in my class and just sat in on the class all day to see what was going on. And the various kids were saying, "Oh, your mom's here." And, you know, anyway, so but it was you know, I think it was a good thing on the whole.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. And my guest today is Peter Thiel, the co-founder and former CEO of PayPal, an online payment system where anybody with an email address can send or receive money using credit card or their bank account. There's a quote about you. Actually, you said, every month you think you're going to die, and every other month you think you're going to take over the world. And this is a emblematic of your sort of roller coaster ride with PayPal.
I don't know if that's something you have at every single company. I think a lot of them do feel like that on the inside, where it is a bit of this extraordinary roller coaster. And I think PayPal was an extreme version of this, and it grew at a rate of about 5 to 7% a day, compounding daily. So when you compound math is very powerful. So, you know, by mid-November, we were up to about 1,000 people. By the end of 99, we were up to 12,000. By February 2nd of 2000, we were up to 100,000. By mid-April, we were up to 1 million.
How did you achieve that growth?
Well, we had some initial bonuses that we gave people to sign up. And then in January of 2000, we noticed that a lot of people were starting to use it on eBay. And so we developed a lot of features that were especially targeted for the eBay auction market, and you know, where you had both people who were both buyers and sellers, which meant that you'd send money to someone and they would turn around and they'd buy something from somebody else, and so it was naturally sort of this incredibly viral place where you got phenomenal growth rates. So that was sort of the good thing. The growth was just, you know, off the charts, and then of course there were competitive issues in that. Large parts of the payment industry, you know, are fairly, nothing ever changes. You have sort of Visa, MasterCard, duopoly saw as a threat. There were government regulatory questions about what the regulatory regime for this was. So it was a completely new payment system. So was it a bank? Was it a money transmitter? You know, what were we? And what regulatory box did we fall in? You know, our initial position was, well, we don't we shouldn't be regulated at all because we don't fit into any of the boxes. And then eventually we pushed for being regulated as a money transmitter, similar to Western Union, which I think is probably the correct box. And of course, that's much less regulated than, say, a bank.
So let's dissect that a little more, this Western Union notion. Ironically, I feel like you are innovative in that you are actually using cash to move around from buyer to seller, whereas other companies who were innovating were using, you know, cyber cash or digicash or replacements for dollars.
Yes.
And I was wondering if you thought initially of using those cash replacements or from the inception you said, okay, no, we're going to be a little more old school and use actual cash.
One of the things that was a benefit when we got the company started in 99 was that there had been a whole slew of internet payment companies that had been started in the very first wave of internet companies back in 94, 95 that basically thought you were going to create this new electronic currency on the internet. And by 99, they had all sort of – were all sort of floundering for one reason or another. The biggest one was people were just not using them, and so you know, was the question was, you know, why give someone cyber cash? You know, we could give you a chicken, or we could give you, you know, Malaysian ringgit, or we could give you a U.S. dollar, and in fact, currency is a massive network phenomenon, and you know, the reason, you know, $100 bill is something that you would like to have is because there are other people who'd like to have that $100 bill, and so we're much better off giving you something which leverages off this already pre-existing currency network than trying to start a completely new one from scratch.
What did you do to incentivize people to adopt the service initially?
Well, we initially incentivized people by giving them referral bonuses.
Of how much?
It was about $10 if you signed up and $10 if you referred somebody else who signed up. So it was $20 per customer acquisition cost.
And were these all your friends initially?
It was initially the people at the company, and then they got other people to sign up and just rolled out in concentric circles like that. And you know, we initially were thinking, you know, this is crazy spending, giving people $20 to get them to sign up. But I realized that it was cheaper than all the alternatives.
How did you even have the cash initially to give $5, $10 per person? Where did you get that capital initially?
Well, we went through a whole series of venture capital financing rounds. Nokia was one of our early investors. We originally started with this sort of wireless small device focus.
How much did they invest?
They invested initially about $3 million. Then we had another financing round late 99. But then in early 2000, March 2000, as the service was taking off, we raised about $100 million, which turned out to be quite fortuitous timing. People, you know, they were lining up to write us checks because it was, you know, at the very peak of the boom.
But then that turned very quickly.
Yes, yes.
So you were very lucky to get
yes.
in to
yeah,
raise
closed,
that money.
We closed the $100 million round on Friday, March 31st. And I remember it was the next Monday the market basically collapsed.
I want to go back to the competitive situation. There were a lot of companies that came and went before you came on board, but there was one competitor that stuck and that might have been a formidable foe for you guys, and that was X.com. What were they doing that made you pay attention to them?
There were a number of people who launched these services around the same time. And basically, Confinity, which had the PayPal service, and X.com were the two that had launched them at more or less identical times and were both growing very, very quickly. It was, you know, this ferocious competition. They were four blocks down the street from us in downtown Palo Alto.
Did you know them personally?
We didn't know them personally, but, you know, you sort of had, you know, you had a meeting every day where, you know, we were exhorting the engineers to, you know, work harder. And it's a somewhat disturbing account of human nature. I'd never seen people work as hard as, you know, when it was like, you know, the enemy is four blocks away. You know, both companies were spending money at an exponentially growing rate. You know, our customer base was growing exponentially. We also had exponentially growing burn rates. And it turned out we were both kind of freaked out about it. And so we finally decided in early March to do this 50-50 combination between the two companies.
Go
which
ahead.
Had all sorts of challenges. So, you know, each company had about 60 people. You combined them into one company with 120. So it was like you hired all of a sudden 60 people that you hadn't interviewed. But it was worth it if for no other reason than that gave the company the necessary momentum to raise that $100 million in March of 2000 that then carried the combined company to profitability.
Whose decision was it to merge with X.com, or at least to start a conversation with X.com? Did you say one day, okay, I'm going to go down four blocks and knock on their door?
It was December 31st, 99. I was on the internet. I decided, well, I have to actually get an account on X.com to see what our competitor's doing. So I signed up the account, and 10 minutes later, the CEO from X.com called me up and said, welcome to our service, and then suggested that we should maybe talk, and we ended up getting together and over the next few months figuring out a way to get the companies to work together.
I want to talk some more about the competitive situation, about the credit card companies and the banks. Why did they look you over initially?
I would say there were two things. One was that the whole thing happened incredibly quickly. So, you know, you have to realize nobody was expecting a new payment service to arise in, you know, a matter of months. And then I think the second part of it was that, you know, at the end of the day, we did not actually take away business from Visa or MasterCard. If anything, we expanded their business because we enabled people to use their credit cards in contexts where they'd never used credit cards before. And so, yes, some of the larger payment companies would have preferred to capture this market for themselves entirely. But at the same time, it was not as though there were people working at these companies whose jobs were being threatened if we were going to be successful, because this was just not a market they were in at all. It was a completely new market.
When you first met Max and you understood that he had a good computer programming acumen, how were you convinced that his technology and the technology that you were building was ironclad and was more secure than everybody else's? I mean, because that is really the heart of your business, is
yes,
to be able to transact in a very secure, protective way.
Well, there were several technology challenges. I mean, one was obviously to make the thing scalable so that you could serve millions of people and it wouldn't break. And Max had actually built some scalable systems before, so we're pretty confident on that score. The security piece was a bit trickier in that, you know, we didn't quite appreciate all the security challenges that we would have. In some ways, had we appreciated them, we might never have launched the company. And it's not like it's a single tech problem to solve. It's more like this iterative process of dealing with all kinds of different, very creative people in, you know, Russia and various other places trying to figure out new and improved ways to steal your money. You know, there were conventional ways you could have solved it by requiring, you know, enormous amounts of information about each customer before they used the service. But that would have just basically made the service unusable. So you have to sort of look at the fraud problem in the context of some of the other challenges, such as the convenience challenge. And so the real issue was this trade-off between how much fraud would we tolerate versus how inconvenient did we want to make it for customers.
That's right.
If there was no trade-off, you could have stopped the fraud pretty easily, but you would have pretty much shut down the service too. And this was actually one of the challenges a lot of the large banks had. They were very focused on the fraud problem, but they ended up creating services that were basically unusable. And I think that ended up being one of the most valuable technologies that actually was developed. It was certainly not what we thought was going to be the core technology, but it turned out to be a core competitive asset just because people were not willing to enter the business because they didn't understand the fraud problem.
We did talk before about eBay becoming a surprisingly good complement to PayPal. And after you went public in 2002, eBay bought you shortly thereafter. How long were you public before eBay bought you?
Well, we took the company public in February of 2002, and then eBay announced the acquisition in July, 5 months later, and it was completed in October towards the end of 2002. So it was, we had had conversations with eBay for a number of years before then. There clearly were enormous synergies. It was very difficult to know what the right value of it was. Once the company had been taken public, there was sort of a market valuation on it, and then it was much more straightforward at that point to negotiate a deal with eBay.
How much money did you raise in the public offering?
We raised about $70 million. We'd raised about $220 million in private capital beforehand.
I've heard before that you think that PayPal is linked to sort of international peace or prosperity. And I was wondering if you can narrow that down a little bit more. What do you mean by that? Let's say
That's so megalomaniacal. You know, I think that if we can have a system in the world based on trade instead of people fighting each other, that would be sort of make for a much, much better world. And that's, you know, I'm very much in favor of free trade, free movement of capital, you know, trying to help people forge commercial relationships across all sorts of geographic and cultural barriers. And I thought that sort of the critical part of the infrastructure for that is a seamlessly functioning global payment system. The T-shirt slogan was PayPal was the new world currency. And I think that turned out, you know, we didn't quite live up to that, but I think to the extent we've pushed the envelope a little bit more in that direction, I think it has made the world a better place. I really do.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Awesome. Thank you very much for having me, Jesse.
My guest has been Peter Thiel, the former CEO and co-founder of PayPal. To learn more about the show, visit our website at fromscratchradio.org, where you can download a podcast on iTunes, follow us on Twitter, or join us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.